The month of April is usually notorious for lots of rain yielding Mayflowers glorious. We must master a skill, and it's tough, I must say, sharing an umbrella from 6 feet away. Welcome to Spectrum West, folks, an entertaining space for sheltering in place. I'm Al Ross, and as we continue our individualized existence, Wisconsin Public Radio is your consistent companion. We're making the most of a situation in the hopes it helps you guys do the same. This week on the show, a National Poetry Month salute continues with yet another of our fine West Wisconsin poets, Bruce Taylor. Jim Oliver is going to share a conversation he had with the author of a book about the history of the Great Lakes and how navigating them changed America. Theaters and performing spaces are quiet and classrooms are empty, but people like Amber Dernbach and Tabitha Tetro are making sure young actors and improv enthusiasts stay in shape and continue to learn the craft. And right here is where the dialogue begins. At times like the one in which we find ourselves currently, food banks take more of a center stage role. Usually they're part of our societal infrastructure, running efficiently, but kind of under the radar. However, today their importance escalates with each passing week. Feed My People Food Bank is a hub around which food pantries in many other west and west central Wisconsin counties turn. FMP Executive Director is Emily Moore. She and I spoke the other day. What prompted me to want to chat, receipt a while back of your spring 2020 newsletter, and it was very evident, at least at this point, that it was printed and distributed prior to the situation we find ourselves in today. Plus, the newsletter's cover has a photo and a headline, Serving Our Elderly Neighbors, and that's a segment of our society that's most affected by what's going on, a fact that is present but not very well accounted for in some parts of the country. The theme of your written contribution to the newsletter had to do with the strength of partnerships. You identified a couple examples, Stepping Stones, Dunn County, and how folks rallied in Sawyer County to plug a distribution hole. And now partnerships, as it turns out, are more important than ever. What you do is built on gathering, not distancing. So how are you guys doing?
I think really the power of our network is important, so I'm glad you brought that up, and that those connections that we have, and we are seeing that in time of crisis, just how important that is. So one of the things that we've found is just communicating with each other. And so, you know, once a week we have a phone call just to check in and see where each of us is at and how the food bank can be supportive of that. And, you know, I think being there for information, to know about what each other's doing, to sort of make the adjustments and the changes and to have, you know, some leadership and some understanding of what others are doing as well. And then, you know, and then responding to individual needs, supplies they don't have or access. If we could just pack some food boxes and get them ahead, they feel like they could then manage or, you know, things like that. And so it's really nice to be able to feel that we're working together and to address the problem.
Yeah. As you said, you have a big operation within an even bigger network. Describe to our audience, if you would, please, what it was like for Feed My People as things became evident that we were going to have to adjust. I'm sure you have contingency plans for natural disasters, but maybe not for this kind.
Yeah. So there's a number of things to bring up there. And the contingency plans, you know, I think our network is really strong in its ability to help one another, and that's at the national level. Mm-hmm. And so if there's a disaster in a community, there's a quick rally around, first at the level of the food bank, and then other regional food banks and the national food bank checking in to making sure there's enough for that area and easily diverting. But when it's the whole country all at once, yeah, that really just changes the intensity and that sense of, oh my gosh, how are we going to do this? So, yeah, immediately it felt like we just need to respond. I remember it was Friday, towards the end of the day, that there was a decision that the Eau Claire schools were going to close. And then very quickly it became, okay, Monday is going to be the day. And we were able to quickly get bags of food out to the schools, and we were just lucky that we had planned ahead in case there was a snow day, and so we were able to just turn around and get those bags right there on a Monday. in the beginning, it was a lot of just quick response. What can we do today to help the situation that we're hearing about?
And weirdly enough, I think a lot of that stuff came down on Friday the 13th.
I think you're right. Yeah.
Of March, yeah. We're on the phone with Emily Moore. She's executive director of Feed My People Food Bank. Let's impress some people, because I know we have a public service announcement, and it talks about the numbers of people and the geography that you serve. It's what, 14 counties and how many people?
Yes, in a year, we will reach about 70,000 people in that 14-county area, working together with about 200 programs. Typically, in a month, we'll distribute about 600,000 pounds of food within our network. And in March, it was closer to 1 million pounds.
Mm. I brought up senior citizens, and you deliver to seniors. How has that process changed?
We have wonderful Meals on Wheels programs throughout our area, and many of those have reached out to us to ask if we would be able to provide extra bags of food that they could deliver with their normal program, which is a wonderful way to be able to support those that are most vulnerable and at home. The other is we have a number of low-income resident facilities where they're predominantly seniors and also those with disabilities. And at normal times, we'll have a food pantry in a community room, for example, and those had to be closed. And so what we found now is they're open to us coming in with a prepacked box of food and dropping it at the apartment doors.
I'm sure in these times of not knowing, it's wonderful to see the FMP people show up. It's nice to have that package show up. It's a feeling of comfort, I'm sure. Interestingly, almost prophetically, one page of the newsletter defines the word crisis. And then it lists some kinds of crises, not a pandemic, however, but our unemployment situation is going to fit the emergency resources category, I have a feeling. What are you anticipating as far as that phenomenon affecting what and how you do your stuff?
Yeah, I think there are just so many people who have never experienced or used the traditional hunger relief resources before that are now turning to that, because oftentimes with sudden unemployment situations, there's an immediate gap. Mm-hmm. It takes a little while before unemployment funds come in, and this takes a while to sort of reorient to that new lifestyle. And so I think just an awful lot of first time trying to understand and become engaged in the system and the way we're able to be helpful.
Have you seen those numbers going up yet?
Oh, we have, yeah, right away. We're running pop-up pantries in a few locations, and a little bit of fear of coming. They're very quick to tell us, I've never done this before, and that kind of thing. And our volunteers and others are just really good about just saying, what you know, you're welcome, and, mm-hmm. and it's a fairly simple system. So
you bet. We're all in kind of the same boat. Could be.
Yeah. You know, another big change, I think, is when people are first running short and are struggling a bit, they generally in normal times will turn to friends and families first.
Sure.
And not having that safety net to help kind of get through, you know, difficult times and
right.
makes a difference.
Yeah. You had some events in early spring, Empty Bowls and the CVA Sing Concert. Did those come off as planned?
They did. Okay. They probably just got in right under the wire.
Yeah.
So we were very fortunate.
But you had an open house, I'm guessing, last Thursday that did not happen.
That's right. The open house at this point not rescheduled. We'll just wait and see.
Okay. That's
so
good.
As soon as we're back, comfortable to get out and get about, we sure welcome anyone to come by at any time to see us.
Good.
Get a tour.
Wonderful. This is one of those times when groups like Feed My People really come into focus. And to this point, our discussion, you and I, has been about how Feed My People helps other people. But you can't help other people unless people like us help you. So how can we help?
You know, we are still so dependent on volunteers, and actually it's increased from where we were before, providing about 17 full-time employees worth of time. So we really do encourage folks to help out if they can. Obviously, be sure you're healthy. And we're asking people to call ahead and schedule an actual time, because we're spreading people out in order to really pay attention to the social distancing and so on. But all kinds of ways to volunteer here at our location. We need drivers, people to pick the orders, packing, continuous packing for the children, for getting bags each week, and boxes for all of the programs and so on. So we do encourage folks to help out that way if they can. funding is helpful. It's hard to know what to expect in the future, but we know that this is going to be for the long haul.
Mm-hmm.
And then paying attention to what our legislators are doing and support those government nutrition programs, because that really is a very efficient and helpful way to get food to people quickly.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to say we're all in this together and we can get through this together and we've got this, but those are just words. Anybody who has the means to help out, please do so. We're putting healthcare workers and a lot of people up on pedestals because they're on the front lines. And I have to say that people like you and yours at Feed My People belong kind of up on that pedestal as well. So thank you for what you're doing. We'll keep in touch and you do the same, would you please?
Most certainly, and do appreciate your talking with me today.
The website is fmpfoodbank.org. Coming up, some COVID couplets from Bruce Taylor during Poetry Month, and next, improvising when there's no other way on Spectrum West. Support for WPR comes from Charter Bank, dedicated to investing in partnerships and offering Charter Bank business services with small business loans, treasury management services, and a variety of checking accounts. Details are at charterbank.bank. Support also comes from Marquardt Toyota, continuing to offer auto repair and sales with measures in place to protect the health and safety of guests and the team. More information is available at MarquardtToyota.com. In addition to other diversionary and normal topics of conversation, it's noteworthy to ask around how all our restrictions and self-imposed separation are affecting a variety of WPR and Spectrum Westers. The mentoring of young actors and those looking for the benefits of improv is one sector, so we contacted Amber Dernbach, who teaches theater and more at Eau Claire's Memorial High School, and Tabitha Tatro, an improv workshopper and more. There always seems to be a more in there somewhere when it comes to creative folks. Anyway, here's that discussion. This makes a ton of sense to talk to some people who enjoy, are good at, and teach improv skills to others, simply because all of America, nay, all the world, is involved in improv at the moment. All of us, all of us, including our government, making it up as we go.
True.
So, ladies, what a great time for improv. What do you think about that? Amber?
I agree 100%. I think that it's at a time like this, all of us who do study improv, perform it, teach it, have an appreciation for watching it, really can see how this is the time to take those skills like listening and agreement and trying to take an idea and move it forward and apply it to what's happening around us.
Tabitha, you have any perspective from your angle?
Yes, I completely 100% agree. I also think that a good skill with being able to do this with improv is adaptability. You know, like you say, all around the world, like there's a lot of people in situations where they haven't been in before, and, you know, just learning to adapt and listening and just being able to be like, okay, this is where we are now. We're just going to have to go with it.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, what's the phrase? Yes and?
You're right. Yes and.
For some people, they're still saying maybe and. But
right.
Now, on a more pragmatic side, you both are having to adjust in ways that I'm going to assume you never imagined you would. Amber, as a teacher, the way you teach, probably above every other aspect of what's going on, has been turned kind of on its side. You sent me a reply to an email that spelled out a lot of the adjustments that you've had to make on the high school side. Tell us a little bit about those adjustments.
Certainly. Well, typically I spend my days standing face-to-face, and
yeah.
There's often a lot of movement, a lot of performance on a stage, stopping to talk about it in real time, making adjustments, groups of students giving each other feedback. And now we're all sitting at home, and we're looking at each other via Microsoft Teams.
Yeah.
So instead of a large group of mid to upper 20s number of students at a time, you know, we can see four people. There might be other people listening in.
Sure.
But with that platform, you can only see four people. So we've really gotten creative about how we can rehearse, and really it does hone in on listening. That's certain.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different kind of energy, but I'm really thankful that we do have the platform to still see each other and still connect,
mm-hmm.
because it's so important for these kids, certainly for all of them, but I would say especially for all of my seniors. They're finishing out their last few weeks of high school this way, to still have some point of their day where they're engaging in something they love.
Yeah, and you have to kind of feel sorry for them, don't you?
Oh, I do.
Yeah.
I really do, especially in this last, 6-7 weeks of school. There's so many highlights of a student's senior year that
sure.
happen in
yeah.
those last few weeks.
I mean, one of the most exciting days of the year is obviously the last day of school, and they're not gonna feel that.
No, they're not.
That's too bad.
They're not gonna have that kind of closure that you would typically have.
It just hit me, too, as I was reading one of your quotes from that email I alluded to earlier, in which you say, I've been spending a lot of time transferring all of my teaching materials into a digital format. You know, I've been looking at silver linings with a lot of guests here on Spectrum West over the weeks, and will continue to do so. You're getting a lot of stuff done that you may not have ever done before or had put off, and you'll never have to do that again, and you'll be able to fall back on it. In fact, I thought to myself, this is taking the term spring cleaning to a whole new level.
It really is, and, if we ever have a winter like we did last year,
yeah.
there's a lot of us who are in a position now where we could just jump right in.
Yeah.
Keep things going in those sub-zero temperatures.
Yeah, it'll all be seamless going forward.
Yeah, right.
So that's a silver lining.
It is.
Tabitha, in a way, because you're not only involved in improv, but you act on a kind of a regular basis as often as you can. I know Chippewa Valley Theater Guild was mentioned as one of the outlets that you work with. In a way, is this an experience or an opportunity that a good actor simply does not want to miss because heavy stuff in one's life tends to add layers? Am I right about that?
Yeah. I always like to look at the positive sides of life. And I do think that there are opportunities in places where things, the old phrase, when one door closes, a window gets open. I believe how that goes, maybe.
Sure.
I don't really know. But essentially what it is just like looking at the situation and being like, okay, I can't normally do what I would like to do. However, being stuck in my house, I'm able to try to find more creative outlets, making my own videos or writing or holding these improv workshops and just being able to see how I'm able to still connect and hone my own skills as an actor and as an entertainer through these new mediums.
That's Tabitha Tatro, and also on the line is Amber Dernbach. We are talking about theater and improv. They both teach some of each, but it's theater and improv at a distance, which isn't the way it's supposed to be, I don't think. And when talking about this situation going much longer than we anticipate, I have to admit to not actually grasping that concept until I sit still and think about it. Imagine it going for months rather than weeks. All the things those months will change if they happen. I've heard talk of summer and fall. How does that sit with you guys?
This is Amber. I think we'll need to really continue not only explore what we can offer people online, but try and get even more of our colleagues to be offering different forms of entertainment online as well, because people need that, need to feel that, there's other people out there, especially in a community like Eau Claire that really does spend so much of summer going to live events.
Yeah. And Tabitha, you up until a while ago anyway, ran weekly adult improv jam sessions, monthly improv and business workshops. Of course, that's all now in a what I call a health hiatus. At CoLab, tell us about CoLab and how you function there when you are coronavirus-less.
Well, I am the office administrator at CoLab. And what it is that it's a co-working space. We usually target new entrepreneurs or startup businesses, try to give people like a sense of community and a place to feel like we really don't want you to just work here. We want you to be able to grow here. Granted, most of that usually could be done face-to-face, but our team, which is Elaine Colin and Adam Akala and myself, has been doing wonders during this pandemic of still building that community. We've moved completely virtual. Adam has been doing these amazing like workshops and lunch and learns, just all virtually. I feel like we've been really adjusting really well, still being able to have that, and it's been growing since, you know, the extensions and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Being able to have that and have people be like, oh, this is something that I can be a part of, and have like our little Slack channels, and we have like ones that are more serious. Hey, this is like a thing that's going on, or silly ones where we just try to like be together. I mean, every Friday we have like a little virtual hangout, grab our drinks together, talk about what's been great this week, what's been difficult, try to still have that sense of community. And I still hold my improv workshops. I had one last month in March,
mm-hmm.
which we did virtually. It was a test, and it went really, really well, and we're actually doing another one again this Thursday.
Right, and I was just about to bring that up because this show airs on Thursday morning, so I can say you have a virtual rehearsal tonight. You're a member of a couple improv teams as well. So, Amber, where do we go from here? What's it like putting lesson plans together? How you teach now, how does preparation for that differ from what you used to do? Obviously, you can teach in your casuals. I've always done my show in my pajamas.
Much more time-consuming because...
Oh, is it?
Because instead of giving information all at once to a group of people looking at me,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm sending it out, but then I'm getting the questions or the comments all individually. So it's all asynchronous, and it's all those individual replies that I may need to make in order for everybody to understand, you know, what to do or, you know, give feedback to an idea for a project that somebody might be starting. That certainly is something I've noticed. A difference in how time flow goes. But right now I'm spending a lot of time, how are my culminating projects going to look?
Mm-hmm.
All of the projects and all the different classes that would have been on stage, how can we have an experience that's not equal but still meaningful? We'll still have something. We'll have something that kids will get a chance to perform, and it won't be what they originally envisioned, but it will happen.
Yeah. I spoke earlier of silver linings. Are there any aspects of what the kids are going through now you think will be good for them, character building? They might be better off for it in the long run. Everything after this will seem easy. What?
I think everybody, especially anyone who's, you know, in their formative teen years can stand to build some grit, and this is certainly doing that, especially all those kids who are, you know, about to leave home or leave Eau Claire, whatever it is that they're about to do. They'll encounter all kinds of things in the next few years that probably won't seem nearly as difficult as this.
Yeah, no kidding. And Tabitha, your first face-to-face improv workshop, that should be kind of a piece of cake.
Yeah, right? Probably a lot of hugging involved. And I also think, like, it can help build the confidence, too. One of the games that we play in our workshop that's kind of like a radio, quote-unquote, improv exercise is called The Bat, where we all just kind of shut off our video screen and we just kind of just go on sound and build a story from sounds that we make, and we build characters from that. And I think doing that in, like, your own home helps you get more comfortable in, like, your own skills. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense to me. Amber. Parting words for your students? You want to say hang in there? What do you want to say?
Definitely. I mean, I just keep telling kids every day on these video calls that we have or the rehearsals that I have with teams, you're only going to be better because of this.
I like that. And Tabitha, anything, any words of encouragement from the CoLab people?
Well, I know this is airing on Thursday morning, so if you want to join in on the silliness, we won't pressure you. To join, you can just watch Thursday, 7 p.m. There's a Zoom link on our Facebook page, and we're here for you.
Good. Amber Dernbach and Tabitha Tetro, we appreciate you being a part of a special edition of Spectrum West. Keep up the great work, you guys.
Thanks, Al.
Thank you very much.
Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. So nice to have you along. Little Bobby Sanabria in the background there. Well, poets are always writing about the times of their lives, and man, we are not having the time of our lives, but experiencing one of the strangest times of our lives. Poet Bruce Taylor is our special caboose coming up. And if you don't know what a caboose is, ask your grandparents. But first, Jim Oliver's back with a book from University of Wisconsin Press, another fascinating look back at how what we may take for granted or not respect nearly enough actually came into its own and deserves some attention.
Professor Theodore Karamansky is a public historian working at Loyola University in Chicago. His research has focused on American Midwestern history, environmental policy, and American Indian treaty rights. He also has an active research program in the history of the American Civil War and North American frontier expansion, including that of Canada. He has published 7 books, his most recent, Mastering the Inland Seas, being released this month by the University of Wisconsin Press. Professor Karamansky joins us by telephone. Thank you for taking the time to talk about the book.
You're very welcome.
Why don't you talk about how the Great Lakes transformed the United States and Canada, and perhaps the role of the government and how all that came about?
Well, the Great Lakes, for most Americans, it's one of these forgotten features of the heartland. But it's probably the single most important natural resource in the United States. And its unique features have shaped the destiny of course, the Midwest region, but then through that, the entire country. From its industrial history to growth of the republic geographically, even the sectional crisis that eventually brought about the American Civil War. Just as today, it's significant for the millions of people who draw their water from it or their recreation on it.
Yeah, it was interesting. You talked about how the Great Lakes were pretty much forgotten by everybody until Gordon Lightfoot wrote his song about the Edmund Fitzgerald.
I was a young college student going to one of his concerts. People in the audience got a little restive as he paused between numbers. Some would shout out, play the Canadian Railroad Trilogy or play this song or that song. And he just kept wanting to play songs from his latest album. Summertime Dreams was the name of the album at that point. Mm-hmm. And he's always been a little bit crotchety. He went ahead and put down his guitar, took the microphone and really berated. We live right on the shores of the Great Lakes, and we don't know anything about them. We don't pay attention to what's happening. And just months ago, you know, a ship sank on the Great Lakes, and it barely even received notice in the Chicago newspapers, which was true. And then he began to play the song, The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, probably his most famous and beloved composition. But I think what was really significant about the song and the reason that it received such an immediate and warm reception, it came on the heels of some really negative things that had taken the Great Lakes and diminished them in the eyes of not just the country, but the people that lived here. In the late 1960s and through the early 70s, we had the alewives, millions and millions of these small little silverfish washing up on the beaches, turning them from desirable locations to places of putrid decay. And also, of course, in the 1970s, the really frigid economy in which so many of the real standard industries in the region began to suffer, especially the steel making. The Great Lakes region was the core of the United States steel industry, but also, of course, automotive industry. We were losing jobs. And the thing that we probably took most pride in the Great Lakes economy was that, you know, we were the industrial heartland. We were the big shoulders of American production, and we lost that. And then the lakes themselves became unpleasant. And so I think what Gordon Lightfoot did is awoke the people of the region to the fact that there was this richer heritage that had been forgotten. And then right about the time that song came out, the Clean Water Act of 1972 began to kick in, and there was a rebirth of recreation on the Great Lakes.
I remember in my youth when the St. Lawrence Seaway was considered a wonderful addition to that area. You don't agree with that?
No, definitely not. I think that Dan Egan's book, The Death and Life of the Great Lakes, really made it a very effective case. You know, they predicted that connecting the Great Lakes through direct navigation to the Atlantic Ocean, that just in Chicago, this would create 800,000 new industrial jobs.
Wow.
For a metropolitan region of 3 million people. So there were pie-in-the-sky expectations.
Mm-hmm.
And it never had a chance, in part because the seaway was underbuilt. The locks, St. Lawrence River to Lake Ontario, were too small. For ocean-going vessels that would have been economically viable. It wasn't even by accident, necessarily. This thing had to go through the United States Congress, plenty of representatives from East Coast and Gulf Coast port cities that wanted Midwestern traffic to go either down the Mississippi or by rail to the coast.
He is Professor Theodore Karamanski, the author of Mastering the Inland Seas. Some of the things I found amusing or interesting or however you want to look at it, I guess. The difference between how European seamen made their way on the Great Lakes as opposed to American seamen.
The maritime traditions that developed on the Great Lakes eventually became sort of unique unto themselves. But it only happened after there was a direct transfer of maritime culture, maritime material culture from saltwater to the lakes. So there were lots of, you know, important innovations and technology that came, many seamen from saltwater, but there was always condescension on the part of saltwater sailors. And with that came a tendency to discount the dangers of these enclosed waters. To someone born and bred on the Atlantic, they seemed diminished as mere ponds. We saw that with the first named vessel to wreck on the Great Lakes, the Griffin. The person who was piloting the vessel got into a storm on Lake Huron. He started cursing Robert de La Salle, who had sponsored the building of the ship. He started cursing him for taking him away from the ocean where he had been a great mariner to this nasty freshwater lake.
The development of canals.
It's probably one of the notable features of the Great Lakes. They're fully integrated into really a continent-spanning network of other navigable waterways. And certainly that played a huge role in the development of the economies of the Great Lakes states. The most famous of those connections, the Erie Canal, and what it did for the state of New York, and really making New York City the metropolis of the nation, or the numerous canals in Ohio integrated the entire state from the Ohio River to the shores of Lake Erie. The role of the Illinois-Michigan Canal in making Chicago the main metropolis on Lake Michigan. So these were all very important. While some of those waterways, like the Chicago Canal connection, continues to be controversial, they're also still very useful in terms of our economy.
Getting on to developing the system of lighthouses, you said there was a lot of dragging of feet by the Congress.
And this was true for all lighthouses in America. They'd basically put an accountant in charge of maritime infrastructure for the nation, and America's navigation aids were inferior to those of any of the other advanced countries in the world. That accountant, his name was Stephen Pleasant, and in the dark days of the War of 1812, when Washington was abandoned, he had the presence of mind of saving the original copies of the United States Constitution and the Declaration of Independence and getting them out of Washington, D.C. before the British could burn them like they did the White House. So people felt, we owe this guy something. They put him in charge of something he had no ability to manage.
Lake Superior was the last of the lakes to be developed. What took so long?
You had the rapids at Sault Ste. Marie. For a while there, they were able to use the log rollers and pull a few vessels into Lake Superior waters, but you couldn't undertake significant navigation that way. And it's really to the credit of the state of Michigan that that canal got built. Congress wanted nothing to do with it. Even Henry Clay, a big proponent of internal improvements, even he was going to have a canal far northern Michigan. he went ahead and compared it to being on the dark side of the moon. But people in Michigan knew there was very rich mineral wealth on the shores of that lake, copper and iron in particular. The state of Michigan just kept pushing the issue and getting bills before Congress. And finally, they were able to get Congress to give a land grant to the state of Michigan. And then Michigan went ahead and sold some of actually its finest timber lands. And those were used to get the money to build the canal. In the 20th century, this was one of the most critical arteries in the world, with more traffic going through it than the Suez Canal by far. And in World War II, it was seen as absolutely essential to American defense production.
One final thought that I found really interesting was you mentioned the Civil War. The Great Lakes were also part of the Underground Railroad.
Absolutely. And there's been a lot of fine research in the last 5 or 6 years talking about the role of the Underground Railroad in the Detroit area. Less well known is Lake Erie ports like Sandusky and all that played a significant role in transporting escaped slaves across to Canada. There really was no safe place for an escaped slave in the north, and we share the border on the lakes with Canada. But even before all that happened, the idea of developing an infrastructure on the lakes, which is really at the heart of this book, is that how do we go from having this vast watery wilderness and turn it into an industrial highway? How does that happen? It happens because of the intervention of the federal government over decades. The South refused to let this happen, and it was only after the Civil War that the Great Lakes could really take off as the industrial heartland.
We've been talking to Professor Theodore Karamanski, author of Mastering the Inland Seas, How Lighthouses, Navigational Aids, and Harbors Transformed the Great Lakes and America. Thanks so much for being with us. This is a fascinating book.
You're very welcome, Jim. I appreciate the opportunity to talk.
I will wager there were several things revealed in that conversation that you were not aware of. As is usually the appealing result whenever Jim Oliver chooses a topic, thank you, Jim. This is Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Support for WPR comes from Charter Bank. At this time of isolation, Charter Bank is investing in connection and offers online and mobile banking with staff available to assist. Charterbank.bank. Connected with you in mind. Well, if you've caught any of our previous April shows, you've come to realize and hopefully appreciate it's National Poetry Month. And maybe that appreciation is carried over to ingesting and digesting more of it, possibly even trying your hand at it. Our next Poetry Month guest is former Eau Claire Poet Laureate and Emeritus UWEC Professor Bruce Taylor. As we commemorate another National Poetry Month, one that, like the coronavirus baby boom predicted for several months from now, may be remembered for producing more pieces than many other times in history, here we are talking with one writer who always seems to surprise us with, if not his creativity, then his disregard for poeticette, conjuring up titles like Poetry, Sex, Love, Music, Booze, and Death. So, knowing that one would naturally want to hear his take on the fix in which we find ourselves, where our health and our politics are tangled and dependent on one another, our appetite for Taylorisms is heightened after reading the quote, "Part of me knows I should be writing comforting, reassuring words to help with the hard times we're all facing, but I guess I just have to leave that to others better suited and better at it." So first, welcome back, Bruce Taylor.
Thank you, sir. Glad to be here.
And next, since others are better suited for comforting and reassuring, what's your calling?
Well, I always think of Miles Davis, you know, who used to say he doesn't play the notes, he plays the spaces between the notes.
Mm-hmm.
And that always just seemed important to me. And I really do mean it. If you look online or something, and good, I'm glad for this. There's more poetry being written, I've always said, right now in this country than probably ever before. And this is just fueling the fire. And everybody wants to say comforting things that will make people feel better, you know. But I just have a distrust of that. I just wonder about motivation. And even if it's not motivation, I wonder about, is that the only thing that's good for us now, is to hear reassuring words and hope? And I can't be not in favor of those things. But I just, you know, my hackles go up just a little bit.
Now, before we get to how you are reacting on paper or keyboard to what's going on, a few general questions, and maybe they're diversions in a way. You taught creative writing, literature, and film on the collegiate level. Were these simultaneous courses, or were they spaced out over the years? What I'm asking is, did you teach them all at the same time? And then I'm wondering how they fed each other. Did you have a lot of the same students throughout?
Yeah, well, you know, actually, when I think of that, creative writing, composition, literature, they really are all the same thing. They all come from the same place, and they're all going to the same place. They were divvied up into specific kinds of courses that were labeled one thing or another, but there was a lot of cross-fertilization going on there.
How about the film part of it?
That's a little different, but still, you know, you're still talking about imagery, and you're talking about rhythm, and you're talking about how to build a character and how to extend a plot. That's, you know, pretty close to me, to literature and creative writing.
Mm-hmm. How did you see what you did or had to do as a mentor, as a teacher, as a professor? How did you see that change over the 35 years that you taught?
Well, it was just a different stance. When I first got there, I was not that much older than my students. I started here about 25. And I was the youngest guy in the department by, 10, 15 years or more. And then all of a sudden I turn around twice and I'm the oldest guy in the department, you know. And these kids were born about the same time my grandkids were. So that puts you in a different position. There are some things you can do early on that you can't later, and vice versa. You know, but I think the thing that is constant for me is, particularly with the writing, I had two absolutely steadfast distinctions here. I would not lie to anybody about their writing, ever.
Okay.
Number one. And number two, I would always remember that I was talking to a person, you know. What we wanted to do was to make everybody a better writer, everybody a better reader.
How did what you wrote and what students wrote, how did that evolve over the years?
Well, mine has been pretty complex. On one level, I tend to start with something, and then it changes to something else, then something else. But if you go all the way back, you can see the early seeds to it. I was looking through some old journals, maybe 15, 20 years ago the other day, and I found lines that I'm still trying to fit into poems, you know, in lines that have gone into poems in the last few years. So for me, I'm just glacial in the way that I work and my writing, and I wish that I wasn't. You know, I wish I could be a different kind of writer. The students, you know, in some ways haven't changed much because they're 18, 19, 20 years old. But of course, to be 18, 19, or 20 years old now is quite different than to be 18, 19, 20 in the early 70s when I started.
It is kind of nice, though, when you go through old materials to come across a line every once in a while, a phrase or a stanza that you sit back in the chair and go, wow, yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah. But on the other side of that, you know, if you're looking at a journal 15 years ago and you realize, I haven't found a place for this line yet, what makes me think I'm going to do it now?
Well, but it's always there.
Yeah.
You know. You'll be someplace completely unexpected. It's like finding that piece of a puzzle that fell on the floor.
Yep. Usually when you're not looking for it.
That's either, exactly, you know? It. Bruce Taylor on the phone with us, former Eau Claire City Poet Laureate, UW-Eau Claire Emeritus Professor. And he is our latest guest as we celebrate National Poetry Month. I don't know if poets actually celebrate it, if they commemorate it, if they bake cakes. I have no idea. But, you know, we like it. And it actually is one of those poetry months that we're going to remember for a long time. Back to your days as a mentor and now as a former mentor, do you get examples of work from former students yet?
Yes, I do.
You do.
And also, you know, since I'm curating this column, volume one, I'm doing the local lit thing. I get a lot of, you know, submissions from the Chippewa Valley. And I try to, you know, if I'm not using something, when I send it back, to talk about it. And again, try to help this person. Remember, they're a person. And yeah. Try to help them become a better writer, better reader of everything. But I'm delighted and I'm pleased at all the talent that's out there, and the number of people writing in this area is phenomenal. You know, I'm still astounded by it.
The second part of my question was, if you get things from former students, and let's say they are writers now, or they are professors, or they are whatevers, I was wondering if you accept their material with thanks, or do you have the urge to comment and correct?
Yeah, well, of course, you know, you can't stop that. And my line is always that, you know, I'm not showing disrespect for the poem. I'm showing respect for the poet. Plus, if they're former students of mine, they know what they're going to get. If they're good students, they've already got in that position with me. So if I send them something, they're going to be correcting me, you know, and telling me what they think works and doesn't.
Okay, so what has the pandemic done to or with your work?
Well, you know, it's impossible to escape. So I've got a few things here. The first two are couplets, and they're sort of, you know, direct statements. They're maxims, if you want. Mm-hmm. And they were just triggered by what, you know, is there, what's going on. This first one, the Chippewa Valley Writers Guild had sent out a thing saying they wanted a bunch of poems based on the Emily Dickinson line, "Hope is a thing with feathers." Okay.
Oh, sure.
And then I just really, about 20 minutes later, I looked out my window down into the lake below me and found my poem about hope is a thing with feathers. And it's called Early Spring 2020. The geese, it seems, have not got the word about social distancing. Neither will the ducks self-isolate, diving as a group and flaunting their feathered asses to the sky.
Yeah, you know, that's a good one. I like that one.
It was one of those moments when I just looked and I went, oh. And it ties into the feather, so I'm very proud of that.
Uh-huh. And feathered posteriors.
Yeah, yeah. And the next one is, you know, has to do with, you know, a monstrous irony that everybody recognizes, but we try to, you know, not think about too much, which is, as you said, you know, what's the motto out there? We will get through this together, staying apart, getting together, all that. So this one is called Let's Keep in Touch. We say online in texts and emails, instant messenger and Instagram, get through it together, we say, from 6 feet apart and walking away.
Yep.
The irony gets me there. Yeah, and then this one ties in with a whole other group of things I've been doing where I sort of do, I call it nonfiction poetry. I steal headlines. I stack them together. Anyway, you'll hear it when I do it. And it's called Meanwhile in Related News, because if we look out there, of course, all the news, it seems, is only about this. That's all that is being talked about. Mm-hmm. But here are some headlines one would not think of immediately as being related to what we're going through now. So it's Meanwhile in Related News. Virtual beer pong becomes an emotional lifeline. Join choir for a community sing-along in isolation. Goats take over town in coronavirus lockdown. The U.S. currently has an abundance of chicken wings. Police in Czech Republic tell nudists to wear face masks. Robot mannequins will cheer on Chinese professional baseball team. Trash collectors overwhelmed by rising amount of household waste. Dad finds whole car buried under lawn while gardening during lockdown. Italian police move quickly against women walking a turtle. Police department reminds residents to wear pants while checking mailbox. Police department remind residents to check their mailboxes.
Now, are those made up?
No, they are all out there. I may have edited them a little to get them to fit into the form, but no, those are real things.
You sent me one that had a California woman cared for her perfect plant for 2 years and then found out it was fake.
That one is a companion piece because it's called Meanwhile in Other News, while this one is in related news.
Oh, I see. Okay, so that's other. That's a whole different deal. So I gave away the last
one. No, that's fine. I can't seem to find it right here in front of me. But those were all real headlines. Again, you look at what's out there and you think this is all that's being talked about. You know, there are people out there taking care of fake plants for 2 years. Yeah. Probably need to hear about them, too.
The book that I previously mentioned, Poetry, Sex, Love, Music, Booze, and Death, a couple of years ago now. Are you working on something?
Well, right now I've been working, like with those headline poems, on something, this new collection. I'm almost done with it. It's called American Memes. When I started to think about memes and actually write about it, because I just know anything, and I found out that I always thought a meme was a picture and, you know, a phrase or something, but it's really just a cultural unit that develops on its own and has its own life. Mm-hmm. And certainly languages like that, particularly forms of languages like headlines, for instance, or when I think about spoiler alert, how many years ago we wouldn't have known what that is, or shelter in place. If someone had said that 3 years ago, what the hell are you talking about? You know, nobody would know.
I've been enjoying every morning in my email inbox a thing called Poem a Day. That's from the Academy of American Poets, their website, poets.org.
Another thing that site does is you can go to it and search for poems about certain subjects. It's really a vast collection of poetry, and it's very accessible to find the kind of thing you're looking for.
Well, one thing we don't have to search for in Western Wisconsin is good poets. Bruce Taylor is one of them. Thanks for helping us celebrate National Poetry Month, and we're looking forward to your next volume. And I know that you and I will talk again and again and again as time goes on.
I am delighted. Just keep looking in your mail. Your National Poetry Month present should arrive anytime now.
Ooh, thank you.
Yep, thank you.
Yeah, pay a visit to Bruce's Facebook page. You'll satisfy your desire for more information. Our final National Poetry Month guest, Amory's own Lemoyne McLaughlin, next week. Spectrum West will continue to shape itself week to week around current events and offer diversions as a reminder that life indeed goes on. Episodes of the program are available at WPR.org. Click Shows, Spectrum West, and the date. You can listen and or download. Thank you for being in the audience. Guys, thank you for doing your part in what needs doing. Thanks to Dean, Kate, Catherine, and Jim. Live safe and smart, and let's get together again next week, shouldn't we?